Hey folks, welcome back again to The Ferment. As promised, I'm delighted to share with you a conversation between David Cayley and Dugald Hine that took place just this last Sunday via Zoom. I was very happy to play a bit of matchmaker for this conversation along with the UK singer-songwriter David Benjamin Blower, also someone you should check out if you haven't yet already. Dugald recently wrote and published a book called At Work in the Ruins, Finding Our Place in the Time of Science, Climate Change, Pandemics, and All the Other Emergencies. The book draws on Illich quite a bit, and David was one of the reviewers of the book, and so anyway, I'm connected enough to David Cayley and David Benjamin Blower is connected well enough to Dugald Hine, and we're connected well enough to each other that we said, hey, let's get these two together. And in fact, let's get a few more folks together. There's another writer, Sam Ewell, who recently wrote a book on Christian mission as it was changed quite radically for him with the influence of Illich. So that's a conversation between David and Sam that we'll be having in a couple weeks. So you can look forward to a recording of that. But in the meantime, I'll just drop you right into the conversation after David Benjamin Blower and I did some introductions, but I'll just drop you right into the conversation where we kind of hand the microphone to Dugald, and he begins by talking about kind of where his book lands and some of the kind of key Illich connections as a place to begin the conversation. And they speak for about an hour, and then there's a bit of time for some discussion questions. Yeah, thanks again to Dugald and David for being willing to do this. David Benjamin Blower for recording it, and also his friend Taylor Reed for helping out with the tech stuff. Just delighted to be able to share this with you all. Peace and all good.
It's lovely to be here, and you know, I feel kind of shy and kind of excited to be in conversation with you, David Cayley, from, you know, although I don't come from Canada, so I haven't grown up with your voice on the radio in quite the way that some folks here might have done. I've been listening to your voice and, you know, reading the words of your conversations with Illich for a long time. And so I feel like we're arriving here with a friend in common. And I feel like I can say that because that's a way that Illich himself used to speak. He used to speak about having this dear friend, Hugh, who had lived 800 years ago, Hugh of St. Victor, who was so important in Illich's later work. And it occurred to me as I was sort of preparing for today that, you know, friendship carries a surprising weight in Illich. And I noticed that again, sort of traveling back through Illich's work with the book that David has written, An Intellectual Journey, that's a wonderful companion to and extension of Illich's thinking, the way in which again and again friendship turns up carrying more weight, more significance than that word is used to carrying in our modern conversations. And, you know, I can say quite straightforwardly that in a way that really I could only say of a handful of other people, some of whom I met in the flesh and didn't, I don't know who I would be if I hadn't met Illich nearly 20 years ago through his writing and the journey that I've had along with those words of his, and increasingly with, you know, getting to know many of his friends and collaborators over the years. And I can't imagine that I would have written At Work in the Ruins if I hadn't had that encounter with Illich's work and then with the circle of his friends. And it's also true that, you know, one of the catalysts for the book was paying attention to the questions that David was asking during the pandemic, and the way in which it seemed like they, you know, there's a great, for those of you who haven't listened to it, it's really worth it. There's a 24 part radio series called How to Think About Science that David made, which I have been introducing people to for years and years and years. And it's such a powerful, you know, journey through the and around the sort of history and philosophy of science with these different voices getting to speak in depth. And it really struck me during the pandemic, the way in which the boundaries had been redrawn so that it became very hard to think about science, because, you know, all of the thinking was meant to be being done for us by science. And then the role for the rest of us was to pass on the instructions. And there's a section in At Work in the Ruins called Asking Too Much of Science. And it's written very much from my experience of working with climate scientists. And the point that I'm making in it is, you know, it does science no good to be asked to play this role. And, you know, scientists, when they're speaking with quietly and with self-awareness, will often say the same thing, that it puts an untenable weight on the work of science when we have this kind of capital S, you know, the science, being deployed in the way that it has increasingly been deployed in many fields in recent years. So that's part of how I started writing At Work in the Ruins. I suppose the other bit that's worth saying at the start of this conversation is a word or two about the ruins, because what I'm talking about in the book is, on the one hand, the ruins of the promises of modernity, this sense of living at a time which I think Illich saw, you know, ahead of almost all of us, and with a clarity that becomes perhaps easier to hear now than it was in his lifetime, the extent to which we were already living after the failure of the promises on which modernity had been founded. And, you know, my book starts with this sense of, you know, all my adult life, there having been this growing sense of living at the end of the world as we've known it. And then the question, well, so what comes after? What's worth doing if that's a discernment of the kind of times we're in? But it's also the ruins which modernity makes and the ruins on which modernity was founded. And again, it's Illich who helped me see this clearly. You know, he says, or at least what I take, one of the many things I take from Illich is this sense that the place where, especially those of us who've been involved in any way in politics on the left, were sort of taught to start the story of politics, which is with the labor movement in the mid-19th century, is actually, you know, a starting point among the ruins of the failure of an earlier struggle, which is the struggle for subsistence, for vernacular ways of living against an industrialization that was brutalizing and, in its immediate effects in the first generations, you know, was creating an absolute horror. And it's slightly harder to see for those of us who've been the beneficiaries of the achievements of the 20th century, quite how brutal and devastating for, you know, the vast majority of people the early generations of the Industrial Revolution really were. But Illich was one of the people who led me into, you know, seeing clearly that, you know, modernity, for all of the things that it's given us, was founded on the ruining of ways of life that people fought to defend, fought unsuccessfully to defend. And so then the story of the labor movement and the rest of it sort of starts at the point where that struggle has been abandoned, and where it becomes, in Jeremy Seabrook's potent formula, he says, you know, instead of questioning the boundary of industrial society, politics from the 1840s onwards becomes, you know, a struggle over the winnings of it, where the labor movement is saying, you know, you're going to have to make this worth our while. And it's really, you know, for me, it's Illich and his generation in the 60s and 70s who began, partly because of the news that was coming back from the front lines of environmental damage, to begin to reopen the questions that had been sealed in that kind of deal where the politics of left and right from the 1840s, 1850s onwards landed us, where the assumptions of industrial society were unquestionable. And Illich was, you know, the great thinker for me of that generation of, you know, late 60s and 70s, who were, you know, bringing those questions back into view again. That's unfinished work, and that's part of, you know, looking for what makes sense now in the ruins. And you know, when I turn to that question of, you know, what kind of work makes sense, I remember a line which I'm not sure is written down anywhere, but which I've heard attributed to Illich in his later years, which is, the limit of political possibility today is the number of people who can sit around a table and share a meal. It sounds very bleak the first time you hear it. But what I always say is, well, I don't know about you, but I need to eat at least two meals a day. And there's nothing in that statement that means that we all have to be sitting at the same table meal after meal. And therefore, you can actually derive from that a picture of a way in which things can spread and come alive and touch the lives of many people without scaling up in the way that industrial society and industrial era politics has assumed that organization needs to do. And the other bit is that, you know, at that table with Illich, there must always be the empty seat for the stranger, the friend I haven't met yet, the one who might show up at my door even now, even in a world which has forgotten so much about hospitality. And and that's the sense again in which Illich gave me the capacity to speak about hope in a time where that word has been cheapened or misused, and where some wise folks, you know, people like Stephen Jenkinson, would suggest that we might be better off without that word altogether. But I got from Illich this sense of the kind of hope worth having, which is precisely, you know, that not having expectations, but remaining open to surprise, remaining open to the stranger who might show up at your door. And however much we know and however much we have good grounds to fear about the depth of the trouble around and ahead of us, not to fall into the hubris of thinking that we know how the story ends in the way that we're often invited to. So I guess those were some bits that seemed worth bringing to the table at the beginning of this conversation. David, I'm sure you've come with some things as well, but I'd love to just hear you share a bit more about your friendship with Illich and the different seasons in your lives in which you spent time with each other.
Wow. Well, I met Ivan first as after 2 years in a development organization, which was resembled, although it was Canadian and predated the Peace Corps, because Canada is a small country and the United States is a large one. One always had to identify it as the Canadian Peace Corps. It was called CUSO. And so I had lived in Northern Bone Arrow for a couple of years and had many puzzling experiences, let's say. And it was Ivan's a talk that I think is quite well known now, usually circulates under the title To Hell with Good Intentions, although that wasn't the title he gave it, that began to focus my understanding. So I was a pretty young man then. So I suppose he was my guide, my primary guide ever afterwards, although we didn't. And we did bring him to Toronto in the following year, 1970. But I didn't really become connected to him until he came back to Toronto in 1987 to address a meeting on orality and literacy. He had, which was put on by the successors of McLuhan. And Ivan had then just done a book called ABC, The Alphabetization of the Western Mind, with a co-author, Barry Sanders. And was, you know, he was in many conversations, but that was the media ecology, as Neil Postman dubbed it, conversation, which he was a big part of. So we met then and became connected. And it was my privilege, since I'm introducing myself, to be able to interview him, something which he had initially told me was completely out of the question. And then changed his mind on a moment. And that first book, Ivan Illich in Conversation, although I don't think he ever read it, at least he affected not to have read it, it brought a lot of people to him saying that they understood him better now, including old friends. And that was interesting because he's a very, an amazingly precise and pointed writer. His formulations are quite exact and quite exacting. And I suppose not everyone could read him or read him as he might be read. So that kind of opened some doors. And from that, and at the end of that book, he made a remark which astonished me. He said that he thought the history of the West, he said no less than that, could be summed up in the old Latin adage, corruptio optimi pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. So I think at that moment, I only dimly saw what the idea was, but I could see that this was something that was of vital, vital interest to me. And something he was very reluctant, that he wrote about reluctantly, I suppose because it's a very difficult, explosive topic. And in many ways, we may or may not talk about that, but I conceived the idea that I needed to hear more from him on that subject. And this, and he was by then getting old, he was ill, he was very, very occupied with many other things, and he never did write the chapters he told me he would write on this theme of corruptio optimi pessima. So we did a second series of long interviews at the end of the 90s. But there was great hesitation in his milieu about this, and many thought it was unwise to speak about it. Because, you know, the hypothesis in brief is that the whole history of the West can be understood as a perversion of Christianity. But Christianity has been the scapegoat of the Enlightenment for 300 years. And at the time that we were talking, the clerical abuse scandal had just exploded in Boston. And there were a lot of people who thought this isn't the time to be to be talking in public about Antichrist Ivan. So just you know, button your lip. So there was a great deal of discussion, and that the book that resulted from those conversations, other than the CBC series that Marcus alluded to, was called The Rivers North of the Future and wasn't published till 2.5 years after he died. So, and that book has had an amazing history. It's gone to a lot of places. It's met a lot of people. And I think at the time, in his last years, he felt that he just simply had no interlocutors at all, certainly within the church. He's explicit about that. And obviously, within his circle, such matters were discussed. But so I think it's true what you've said, that the possibility of understanding him has opened dramatically. And the writings that you alluded to that I did during the pandemic, were, they literally arose from extreme puzzlement, astonishment. I mean, about a month in, I couldn't believe what was occurring around me. And I naturally, who am I going to ask, right? So I asked Ivan and produced an essay called the pandemic from the point of view of Ivan Illich. And it seemed to me when I started to think about it that it showed in concrete, in detail, in for all who have ears to hear, let them hear what he had been talking about. I mean, it couldn't have been to me more plain. So I think that moment, what Agamben called the moment of his legibility, has come around, although I don't think that means he was wrong to feel alone. I don't think it means that that his warnings were not heeded in the 70s when they might have been taken up in a different way than the astonishing soup that we're now trying to swim in.
Maybe that's something that's worth us exploring, because there is a sense. So for those who are less familiar than me and David with Ivan's writing, you can kind of divide it up various ways. But one of the things that's clear is that there is this sequence of books from the beginning of the 1970s through to the late 70s, which he himself referred to as pamphlets in hindsight, that are kind of short, sharp, written into a moment where, as he says, I think it's at the beginning of Tools for Conviviality, 2/3 of the world can still avoid passing through industrialization. So he's writing with a sense that the costs and consequences and the gap between the promise and the reality has already come into view in the countries and the societies that have traveled furthest into this process. And there is time, there is a moment in which the direction, in the sense of direction, the course could be changed, and everyone doesn't have to repeat the mistakes that we've made just because we've announced ourselves as the world's most developed societies. And so there is this sort of sense of possibility in the writings then. And I think one of the questions perhaps is, was there a genuine moment of possibility that wasn't seized? Or were Ivan and others who felt that sense of possibility at that moment misreading what was there within that historical moment? And put like that, it's obviously an unanswerable question, yet I think it can be an interesting one to think around. So was there a change of course that could have happened then? And again, I think part of why I'm bringing this question to you, David, is because I think it's quite hard for those of us who weren't alive then, or who were too young to have any kind of awareness of it, to really have a sense of quite what that moment was like. And I think that you lived that and have written quite powerfully about the bits that get hidden behind the cheap story that is told of the 60s, quote unquote. So I'm just curious what you might have to add on that at this point.
Well, I do think that the 60s, as they were for Ivan, so he summed it up in Illich in conversation, saying that there were people coming to him at CEDAW who were prepared to make a new world right now. That's the spirit of Kairos in the Greek Christian word, of the moment of opportunity. It certainly was the 60s as an apocalyptic moment, a moment of revelation, realizing it's in a way now or never, right? This moment is here. But of course, you're right that isn't how people see the time at all. It's now, in most people's minds, a little more than a moment in the history of fashions, right? It's a moment in the history of popular culture. But yes, I think it was utterly real for him, but real in the way that it's the same for us, right? He's because we have hope doesn't mean we have realistic expectation. And Tools for Conviviality is, if you see the book as a kind of gestalt figure, right? Now it's a, now it's two faces, you know, now it's a vase, now it's two faces, now it's a vase. People will be familiar with these, the duck rabbit and so on. If you look at it that way, it's a very bright book and a very dark book at the same time. And I mean, it's most explicit with deschooling. There are a number of essays written after deschooling in which he says that this is imminent, this can't be held back much longer, it's bound to happen. Now there's also another Illich who speaks about the article he wrote for Saturday Review before the book was even published, in which he says that he was barking up the wrong tree because it's the educational function has already migrated into 1,000 corporate shards and there's no point thinking of deschooling at all. So there's all, you know, as for all of us, there's always more than one way of, you know, hope and prudence exist, needfully exist in the same person at the same time. So, but yes, you see the moment of hope and belief, and you see the realist who can't quite believe this. And who will later say, you know, that he had premised his whole hope for what he called a political inversion, right, on an idea that was rapidly passing away, which is that these institutions were in some sense still tools. They were still a distance between those who were using the tool and the tool. So those who are using the tool, even if it's an immense tool like a healthcare system or a school system, could theoretically form a majority and change how they do that. It would have been possible to disestablish schooling, which is what he called for. The term is really, really interesting, but even at the time was hardly noticed that this was a call for a precise constitutional change, disestablishment. It would mean recognizing that this is an institution resting fundamentally on religious grounds, that its ambition is church-like. And that really never was very much in the conversation. It was always seeking to devolve into schools pro and con. But Ivan was never against schools as such, for whatever limited practical purposes people might have for them. That wasn't his issue at all. So I think the only answer you one can give is the gestalt answer, yes and no.
Yeah, and as you say, that's actually there within the texts themselves. I think the other thing, you know, again, for folks who maybe aren't as familiar with Illich, is just to paint a picture of quite how big he was, quite what the status he had as a figure in the 70s was. And, you know, one of those pamphlet books, Energy and Equity, early drafts of it were sort of published on the front page of Le Monde. There was a big New Yorker feature on one of those huge things that only New York magazines do, that's like a third of a book in length, about profiling Illich, about his kind of battle with the Vatican at the point where he ended up stepping down from the active priesthood, but also the sense that he had the ear of world leaders, or at least they were curious to meet this guy. That's how big he was, you know, whether it was Indira Gandhi or Pierre Trudeau. And then obviously, you know, for multiple reasons, he falls from view in the early 80s. But there's sort of little pair of stories that I picked up over time that are kind of interesting in relation to thinking about the strangeness of the moment in which this guy was, not only filling multiple auditoria when he came to speak at a university, you know, they were relaying it to all of the other lecture rooms, but also getting invited for meetings with these world leaders. So after he died, the sociologist Peter Berger, who had spent time at the Center for Intercultural Documentation in Cuernavaca in Mexico, which was Illich's base from the beginning of the 60s until the mid 70s, wrote a slightly dismissive article for the New York Times, looking back on Illich. And in it, he tells this story of running into someone who was the Chancellor of Austria at the end of the 1970s and having a bit of conversation with him and saying, what do you think about Illich and his ideas? And this Austrian politician says, it translates as, with this, one can do nothing. And that was the sort of, that was his practical politician's judgment at the end of the era of Illich's most public pamphleteering, attempting to intervene in politics. And around the same time, Gustavo Esteva, who became very good friends with Illich and is one of the people who I learned the most from spending time with within the Illich circle, Gustavo describes how, he reached this crisis where he was working in the barrios in Mexico City with these kind of indigenous landless peasants arriving in the city and self-organizing where there were no effective public services for them and organizing their own communities. And Gustavo, who had already just turned down a job as a cabinet minister in the Mexican government in 1976, and he'd won the National Economics Prize, he said he spent 2 years reading in every academic field he could find to try to make sense of what he was learning and experiencing alongside these folks in the barrios. And finally, he hit this crisis where he had to choose between what his friends and collaborators there were telling him and the way that these people were described in all of the academic literatures. And he said, and when he did, there were only two things that helped him. One was the memory of the stories his grandmother used to tell him in the marketplace in Oaxaca when he was 8 years old. And the other was Illich. And he said, Illich was the only thinker he could bring whose books he could bring to meetings with the people he was working alongside in the barrios, and they could read Illich together, and people would go, aha, yeah, I recognize myself in this. This makes sense of my life. And I think that twinning of the story about the Austrian politician who's like, with this one can do nothing, and the Mexican peasants who are like, this is the only thinker you've introduced us to who actually makes sense of our lives and what we are doing as political agents in our communities at the grassroots, says a lot about what the power and what it's possible to do with Illich's thinking, and how different it looks depending on whether you're sitting in the rooms of government or whether you're reading it in the barrios.
Yes, I think that's true. But I mean, the period of Ivan's celebrity, he could joke about that too, right? And almost the first time we met, he told me that was just because he was rara avis. He was a rare bird. He was so orthodox, they thought he was progressive, that he was, that in a way his vision was so rooted in first millennium Christianity that he was taken as an avant-garde thinker. So he could see the humor of it, although it was very real. I mean, when we invited him to Toronto in 1970, we had to turn people away from a 600 seat auditorium. It was a very real thing. And he responded to it with astonishing diligence. I mean, his journeyings as a kind of jet age St. Paul in the 70s are tiring to read about. He's in London in the morning and he's in Dusseldorf in the afternoon and he's lecturing in Naples in the evening. It's crazy. And I can remember having him come to Vancouver and thinking he was in Seattle, and no wonder. You know, so yeah, it was real, but the Austrian politician has a point, of course. And Pierre Trudeau in Canada, who was an eager and an avid interlocutor, never did anything that was remotely close to what Ivan Spokes would have called for. He didn't disestablish the educational system in Canada, right? So I think Gustavo in the end was right. This is for people who have been forced out of the system that Ivan was unable to change or never been included in it.
Yes, there's a sense that it becomes useful in the ruins. I mean, quite literally in the Mexico City example, where after the earthquake in 1985, these networks that Gustavo had been part of creating, actually, he wouldn't want us to use the word network. He would say, we don't have a network, we have a hammock. These hammocks, yeah. These grassroots, very large organizations, which also then were connected to the Zapatistas when they emerged in the 90s. But, you know, within a week, they went from the government trying to sort of making illegal the composting toilets that they were propagating as a means of dealing with shit in the barrios, to that being the only thing that would work because half of the city had no functioning sewerage left. And it feels like that's a sort of image of part of why there's the moment of legibility now, because the ruins get closer and more real in lots of places that have felt relatively sheltered until recently. And therefore, this thinking begins to become something that can actually inform what's worth doing, rather than being something that you might be fascinated with, but it's impossible to implement from sitting within the systems that you were sitting within in the sort of Trudeau example. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a distinction we can make between, you know, what would you call it, Ivan's maximal political hopes, right? Tools for conviviality, disestablished education. The medical nemesis begins with the hope of a major house cleaning within the health professions, right? This hope of a real inversion, or the idea that you could find and institute democratically a limit, which is the central idea in all the books, right? That there is somewhere a rough and ready judgment that can be made as to what is enough, as to what is good enough, as to what is far enough, right? So the vision finally is of making habitability or conviviality the aim, rather than where we still are, right? Progress now, it's maybe it's in a new register, or what can we do with CRISPR, or what can we, you know, what we can we do with this or that, but there's still the dynamism of progress is in a certain sense undiminished, even though the belief, the explicit belief in progress often isn't there. But what I wanted to do is slightly change the register from these political hopes to Ivan, who's someone who also embodies a way of thinking. And theologically, although he hotly denied being a theologian, show you how what the essential nature of this beast is, right? Which is his most astonishing claim, the one that I kept hounding about in the 90s, is corruptio optimi pessima, the idea that we are living in an inverted and inside out and upside down. There's a lot of different ways, topsy-turvy was another expression he liked, Christianity, I think this the implications of this idea are barely begun to be explored. And he presents it that way in The Rivers Notes of the Future. It's always my research hypothesis. You know, it's not an idea that he presents as a finished idea. It's the beginning of an inquiry. And I think that inquiry, although it's hard to find others who agree with this, it can still be carried out. And with, I think, the objective from his point of view of getting back to the source, right? But not some easy reversion or reflexive reversion to the source, but getting to the source by unthinking. Mm-hmm. We can say it like that, by unthinking the school, by unthinking the hospital, by unthinking all the things that move us along and that keep us captive. So
I mean, to sort of follow you into this set of questions and this side of Illich's thinking, what was striking me as you were speaking then is the connection to Walter Benjamin. As you know, Benjamin has the image in his theses on the philosophy of history of the sort of theology as the dwarf hidden inside the kind of the mechanical puppet that is playing chess, which I think is a kind of, you know, an early version of something which Illich is coming from a different, Illich is not directly running off that in his you know, Corruptio Optimi Pessima, but there are other people who are sort of navigating in the space between the two. I mean, John Milbank, for example, theologically, Slavoj Žižek as well. So there is a kind of a recognition from multiple directions of modernity as being a covertly theological project of, you know, the sort of a self-congratulation on, I mean, it's there in Kierkegaard as well, the sort of self-congratulation on having gone beyond faith, which is the beginning of fear and trembling in Kierkegaard, as being what he sees amongst his sophisticated Danish contemporaries in the mid-19th century. And that actually there have been these deep thinkers, you know, Kierkegaard, Benjamin, etc. And the Illich, partly because he's bringing a Catholic sort of trajectory and set of intellectual resources into that, is bringing other things to the table, partly because he's bringing his historian's perspective and, you know, this thing of, you know, really locating the deep roots of modernity in the sort of the medieval moment of church reform, as opposed to, you know, the Reformation 3 or 4 centuries later, as being the point at which this attempt to institutionalize the promises of Christianity begins to realize something which slowly becomes the kind of, you know, the bureaucratic horror, if you like, of the dark version of modernity. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of sort of threads to put onto the table, but yeah, I suppose it's interesting to me that that it maybe it's possible to discern now because of some of the others who've been sort of navigating in the in-between spaces between these thinkers, connections between where Illich was going in those conversations with you in the 90s that make him look slightly less lonely, which is not to say less original in terms of the insights that he's bringing to the table there about their about modernity as a, yeah, in his terms, a corrupted notion of Christianity.
Well, I think you're, this has long been a puzzle to me, because I encountered this as an innocent, if you like, a man who's always got his education on the fly as a journalist. And so I took Ivan's word that he was quite alone in this perspective. But in a certain way, he left this body of work with me. And I was aware that I was going to pay for what I had asked for, as it were, you know, that I couldn't just say, well, that was interesting, now on to the next program. You know, that was not the way it was. And so I was surprised. The surprise began with a call from Charles Taylor, Canadian philosopher, during the broadcast of The Corruption of Christianity. I had a slight acquaintance with Taylor, and he said, well, this is amazing. This is exactly what I'm working on, right? We had worked together 10 years before when he was doing our annual lecture series. It'd be like the Reith Lectures or something in the UK. That was in 1990. And he didn't really want to talk about Illich. That was pretty interesting that he said, well, no, this is really exactly along the lines I'm working on. And then in what were then his Gifford Lectures, and which became his famous book, A Secular Age. But as I began to, and so he was a crucial part of making The Rivers and Arms of the Future a respectable book, right? It's a preface by Charles Taylor, right? Because by then, who the hell is Ivan Illich, right? The obituary in the New York Times when he died said he, priest turned educator who appealed to baby boomers in the 60s. You know, how much more patronizing can you be than that, right? Like, this is yesterday's man, if you remember him at all. He's the answer to a trivia question. So this was very important to have Charles Taylor on board. But as I began to read, I found more and more echoes. And of course, I never found out whether Ivan had ever heard of Harold Berman, whose book Law and Revolution is a magisterial history of law, which is fully in the spirit of what Illich says about the 12th century revolution and its formative impact on the idea of revolution, right? The idea that he connected to Gerhard Lodner. Here was Berman. He had worked it all out. I don't know if they knew of each other. And Milbank, you know, on the second to last page of Theology and Social Theory, the idea of corruptio optimi pessima is perfectly enucleated in two sentences. Ivan could have written it.
Which is, so it's... So,
Yeah, I'm just saying there are a lot of people working perhaps in parallel with him, and not, he didn't really, you know, it was too late to be in contact.
It's interesting that that comes right at the end of Milbank's book, because it sort of bookends with, on the closing page of Rivers North of the Future, Illich sort of drops in this reference to
Yes.
In the footnote, Catherine picks
because
up.
Me and Lee Hoynatsky were bugging him about it.
Right. Well,
yeah, we were both over the moon after writing Catherine Pickstock's book, which Ivan I don't think he had the energy to read it. And, you know,
But that's interesting, because Gustavo definitely remembered Illich having a copy of the Radical Orthodoxy collection and sort of waving that at him and saying, this is important.
All right, well, that's good to know. All right.
There was clearly some kind of awareness. But what's striking me now, actually, because I'm thinking about some other examples of quite how mainstream this sort of Christianity, like modernity as a continuation / perversion of Christianity, is now. And I'm thinking of, for example, Tom Holland's book, Dominion, which is, you know, a kind of big history, big popular history of Christianity, whose basic sort of thesis is rather blander, let's say, than Illich's argument, but is nonetheless that, you know, none of the world that you are in as a modern is imaginable without these things that are very specifically Christian. And I'm thinking about the way in which, you know, in the kind of current, slightly kind of in the culture war environment, really, T.S. Eliot's kind of arguments about Christianity and paganism are being kind of given a new lease of life. And what strikes me actually is how important Illich's Jewishness is in his identity and in why he doesn't go to some of the places where I get rather uncomfortable with some of this stuff. You know, Illich doesn't go to the kind of attitude, the kind of idea of the having been a Christendom in the Middle Ages that was a kind of political Christian project, which modernity is a kind of sad zombie version of, which is basically Milbank's position as far as I can see. And I think part of why Illich doesn't go there is because, you know, he had that experience of being, you know, his mother was Jewish. When he was 13, he was hauled out in front of the class, made to stand sideways in profile while the teacher pointed to his nose and said, "This is how you spot a Jew." And that's so, and he invokes his dual heritage repeatedly in talks and in texts. And to me, that makes him a more trustworthy companion for navigating in the sort of in the ruins of modernity that are also the ruins of earlier Christianities than some of those who are in many ways, you know, making some arguments that travel a lot of the same way with him. I'm curious if you have any sort of reflections or anything to add on that.
Well, I think you said it. I don't think I can really add to that. I think generally, it seems to me that Ivan threw a bridge to the farthest boundaries of Christianity. It was very important to him from the beginning. All his work in the church and all his preaching of a new church up till 1968, he always insisted that innovation and tradition were an indissoluble, inseparable pair. One without the other was fatal. Sclerosis or disorder. You could only innovate with a foundation and tradition. You could only have a foundation and tradition without suffocating if you were willing to fearlessly innovate. That was the paradox that he presented. That was what he insisted on, and what I think his contemporaries could never take seriously, because politics so far is always about either or, isn't it? One or the other. What do you want in the end? So I think he kept that all his life. The feeling, and, you know, St. Francis, for example, was a revolutionary of that kind, I think. Always insisted on his standing within the church and his obedience. And Ivan insisted on his obedience even at moments when he appeared evidently disobedient. So I think he always wanted to remain within the Catholic Church. But his thinking is so adventurous, and it is so, it appears so much in negative, in the sense that he said to John McNagle, when I was still a young man, you know, that my business is proscription, not prescription. John McKnight was a friend of his. it was John who reported the remark to me, but I think it's true. It's rigorously true. There's very little. I mean, you may find praise of friendship, or but you'll never find detailed prescription about anything. So it's hard to read Ivan in that sense, because people tend to read a thinker, and now who's not there to defend himself, as this is something complete, right? This is Illich's oeuvre. This is René Girard's oeuvre. This is, but to, since I mentioned Girard, he would be a good example of a thinker who, beginning from an astonishing vision, systematically worked out the implications of what he had understood in an amazing way, a model way, really, since I'm a big admirer. But Ivan isn't a thinker of that kind at all. He wrote sparingly. He wrote only for occasions. There were many subjects on which he kept his own counsel. He tried to ensure that no biography would be created after his death, or so he said. And so far, the paper trail remains pretty scant. So that's a different kind of person. What I'm saying is, he limited himself in many ways, and it doesn't mean he can't be a guide to us in thinking these things through, but there's a lot we can still do, I need to do on our own.
Yeah, I can see David Glower sitting there waiting to take us to questions, but I just want to ask you one more question, David, before we do, which is, because I'm thinking about this thing about the, you know, the significance of the Jewishness within...
I didn't answer that, did I?
Within it. Well, no, the question that I'm curious about is the title of The Rivers North of the Future, which comes, of course, from Paul Celan, the great German Jewish poet of, you know, the aftermath of the Holocaust. And I'm just really curious, David, was that Ivan's choice? Was that your choice? I know that it was a poem.
It was my choice, but I thought the book should be called The Corruption of the Best is the Worst. Mm-hmm. And my wife and frequent advisors said, not on your Nelly. That's a terrible title. That's just like, why not just say, don't open this book, right? So I thought, well, all right. I knew that Ivan loved Celan. He really adored Celan and admired those poems and loved poetry generally. And I think once told me as a teenager, he hoped to write like Rilke one day, but he loved poetry. And we had been through some of those poems, and I particularly knew that one, and it seemed note perfect, because of course, where exactly are those rivers north of the future? And it was in meditating on that image. So he chose it in a certain sense. I chose it on his behalf and in response to Yuda's proscription of the other title. But I think when you begin to think, where do those rivers rise that are north of the future? Well, the past is the only place really that they can rise. So it is also an image that can show you that the past is not fixed. And the openness of the future can only be rooted in the openness of the past. If you take this idea of tradition and innovation as a couplet, then so past and future are equally a couplet. They're lost without one another. A past without a future is dead. A future without a past is unbearable. So those rivers, yes, I think are the rivers that we need to revisit now. In the spirit, let's say that Ivan read Hugh of St. Victor as also living, as perhaps all moments are finally, at a moment of change, a moment of decision, a moment, a cusp, if you like, in the 12th century, right? The beginning, the end of monkish reading, the beginning of bookish reading, the end of the beginning of a new philosophy of tools, the end, therefore, of an old philosophy, everything about that he saw, he could look at Hugh and see entirely new things. And I think we can look at the gospel that way. We can look at anything in the past that way. But of course, it's difficult because Canada, and I'm sure it's true everywhere else, is in the grip of a complete oblivion, an attempt to forget the past, right? Or to present it strictly in approved terms as something that is systematically wrong and that has to be gotten over, right? So that's our impotence, I think, in Canada, and I presume elsewhere, right, that we have no future because we have no past. So let's leave it there.
David and Dugald, thank you so much for sharing this dialogue with us and opening out this space for us. At this point, we're past the hour. I would love to open it out to questions. It would be beautiful if we could have three questions answered, which probably means that answers will want to be kind of concise starting points that we can all follow up on later. But I'm not sure the best way to do this. Perhaps if you have a question forming, please feel free either to write it in the chat or just to raise your hand. I'll begin with anyone who would like to dive in by raising their hand.
I'm trying to wave a hand. I don't know if I did it successfully digitally. I have a question about Illich and prayer and caring. Dugald shared some reflections this week about some of the way in which Illich warns us against thinning care out into a feeling. And it made me think about, as I was trying to prepare for prayers this morning in a week full of very heavy news, the question came to me, is prayer just another way of thinning care out into a feeling? Or as I'm sitting here, I wonder about, would Illich say that the way we care today is a kind of perversion of the way we used to pray as a way of sending out a sense of care into the world to those we cannot touch? And I'm just, whom we can't engage with in that direct neighborly way that he so emphasized. And so I don't, like, David, do you have a sense of how Illich would pray about critical world events? Did you ever have any sense of witnessing that or a sense of his practice around that?
Yes. I believe he prayed for me. And in that sense, he must have felt that could make some difference. But the part of his philosophy of prayer that was most meaningful to me occurs in a little essay called The Eloquence of Silence, which is in Celebration of Awareness. And it was a talk he gave back in Puerto Rico when, you know, they were trying to get a lot of American priests and religious who were dealing with Puerto Ricans conversant with their Spanish So language learning was always a big part of what the work he did in those years. But he says that he defines prayer as the farthest one can be from God. The moment of prayer is the farthest one can be from God. So he puts it paradoxically. I may be misquoting, but it is our experience of our difference from God. Our distance is our difference in that sense, right? So I don't know if that's in any way helpful.
I suppose I could say a little bit to the passage that I was reflecting on this week, which is from the first book of Conversations that you did with Ivan David. And it's one of those kind of shocking moments where he tells the story of, he tells it in various places, as the student who comes in and says, "But Mr. Illich, don't you care about the children starving in Africa?" And he's really careful in the answer that he gives you. He says, I will try to rid myself of any sense of care so that I can feel the horror at their situation and my helplessness and the fact that I'm not about to, pick up this object on my desk and sell it and take the money and get on a plane and go and take this child in my arms. Because, for me, in the light of the Good Samaritan, that is what care means. So he's wanting to defend fiercely the idea that care is costly, that care is love in action, and that, we have this sentimental way of using the word care now, which has, got much worse in the age of social media, or much more, absurd in the age of social media, where care describes a feeling that gives me some sense of virtue. Mm. And I think that, it would be interesting to sort of sit with what the kind of, because what he says is, I rid myself of the any sense of care so that I can feel the horror, so that I will not forget what care actually means, so that I will show care to the person who shows up at my door where I'm actually in a position to offer care, and so that I will notice the moment to get involved in something politically in my city that is connected to why the children are starving in Africa. So there's a real kind of chain of different dimensions to it. And it might be interesting to bring the whole of that passage into a reflection on, what's going on, how to avoid sentimentality in prayer, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add, Marcus, one thing to that, because one of the phrases that Ivan is responsible for, and which probably is never going to become a popular slogan, was epistemic sentimentality. And this is particularly emphasized in the essay on life, the address to the Lutherans in 1989. But what he means by epistemic sentimentality is sentimentality that is seeped into our very way of knowing, our way of seeing, of experiencing. So I think that goes with what Dugald has said about that pretty challenging passage about trying to eliminate every trace of care in that sense from his heart, right? That he will eliminate care in order to taste what's real. That he will. So maybe his remarks about understanding our distance from God are related to that, in the sense of that our disposition potentially changes when we understand that, right? When we stop co-opting God, and we stop trying to make ourselves feel better in prayer, which I think you hinted at, right? So, but that's a stern and demanding teaching.
I'd like to relay a question from Esther and Paul Eady asking for elaboration on the phrase "the corruption is the best, the corruption of the best is the worst." Esther or Paul, would you like to say anything or elaborate on that question, or is that enough?
Thanks, David. I don't want to. This may be a phrase that people here are very, very familiar with. I've read some of it, I haven't read all of it. It's obviously a key phrase for you, but on the surface, it's not super clear what he might have meant by it. So there was an opportunity just to hear you unpack that a bit more for a person, people that are slightly more amateur in him. He sense that it's quite a critical phrase, that's all.
It is critical. It's a proverb. So you find it peppered throughout literature. Shakespeare has it, lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds. You find it in Aquinas. You can find it in classical antiquity. It always says the same. And what I think it said to Illich, or what I saw through that lens, was that the best, which is the incarnation of God in Jesus, so what he calls a new flowering of love and knowledge, the ability to love each other in a new way, which he believes to be a revealed possibility, right? It's not in our repertoire, so it has been revealed in the Christ. That possibility is can fall as low as it is high. There's a proportion between them. It's an unusually volatile teaching. It's not a religious precept. In fact, I think he sees the incarnation as the evisceration, the explosion, if you like, of religion, which becomes a religion. So this worst that goes with the best is of a peculiar character, which is related to what it is corrupting. So I think that's the gist of what he means by the corruption of the best is the worst. To say that it sums up the history of the West, you can imagine where my jaw dropped open when I heard that, is to say that the attempt to guarantee, to harness, to build, implement, start adding your own words, that evanescent possibility, right? With the evanescence is evident in his reading of the parable of the Samaritan, where he says, you know, that people have taken this as a teaching which shows you a desirable duty which you have to all others who are in trouble, right? So, well, you know, there clearly should be better security on the road to Jericho, for one thing, right? That road is not properly policed, and we should get busy with that. And there are a lot of other things that probably could be improved on the road to Jericho. There probably should be some sort of first aid station there and so on, right? He says, no, this is the most surprising, unethical, in the sense that ethics then meant taking care of your own. The Samaritan has nothing to do. It's a man from the northern kingdom who effectively had become enemies of the Judeans, whom the man in the dish is a representative. He should have nothing to do with this person, but he answers a call. He answers a bodily feeling that this one is calling him. That is an individual act. And if that is made a matter of desirable duty, if it's turned into a norm, if it's institutionalized as a kind of mechanized charity, it has possibilities unthought of in any previous society or civilization. This is a unique circumstance. It creates a new form of power, the power of those who organize Christianity and deploy this power of love for their political and institutional purposes. So it's embodied in the little proverb is also this sense of the uniqueness of what we're facing. It's not just another civilization declining, all civilizations decline, all civilizations go in circles, nothing to get excited about. No, this is a unique teaching. This is, for him as a Christian, the pivot on which history turns, but he recognizes that not everyone will accept that. That's a knowledge that's available only to faith. But it will actually happen concretely in history that those who organize Christianity will eventually organize the entire world. And that's where we are.
It's very interesting to hear your way of setting that out, David. I mean, what I take from The Rivers North of the Future is Illich makes this distinction repeatedly. He says, I'm speaking as a historian. And, you know, there are moments where the conversation veers into the territory of speaking from faith. But he, you know, he both emphasizes like the uncomfortable intimacy of that, in contrast to the mode in which he's speaking a lot of the time in your conversation. But also, so the way I read it is that he's making this historical argument. He says the thing that is, you know, objectively, like leaving aside my faith, which I can't ask you to share, the thing that is objectively historically new about Christianity is the proposition that there isn't a code of ethics that applies to those on the inside of this group and a different code that applies to the outsider. So it's not one rule for those inside the city walls and another rule, which is our code for how we deal with strangers. It's that through, you know, he sees the story of the Samaritan as the emblematic one, but emblematic of the whole kind of message that's repeating in different ways through the New Testament, that, you know, that division is torn down and that is kind of, aside from what you believe about the incarnation, that's the innovation that's being offered by Christianity and part of where the cultural energy of the church as a phenomenon emerging out of the moment of the New Testament is precisely how radical and different this proposition is. And that, you know, on the one hand, this is the most amazing kind of thing. And on the other hand, it can become the most terrible thing, as you say, once you attempt to legislate to fulfill that, you know, to turn the extraordinariness of the, as Illich always told it, as the Palestinian and the Jew when he told the story.
Yeah, and properly.
And that, you know, once you try to legislate to implement some universal ethics, that's worse than the old limited legislated ethics of, you know, the code that we have for those who are citizens of the city and then the way that we deal with the stranger.
Yeah.
Anyway, we could do a whole session on that, but there's more questions, I can see.
Yeah.
There are more questions. I want to respect our time. We've got 5 minutes left, and I'm aware there's a few pieces of housekeeping, and alas, I don't think any of the questions will be done justice in the small time that we have. What I do want to do is keep a note of all of the questions that have been written in the thread, so that we can. Well, we'll certainly be having the fourth of these gatherings will be a discursive space, and it would be great to bring those questions into that space. But it might be that those questions can also be put on some kind of discussion thread. We'll have to talk about that and let you all know about it. But for now, I think I just need to thank David and Dugald for sharing this dialogue with us. and thank everybody else who's come to listen and be part of the discussion. I'm very sorry. I feel the weight of all of the questions that we didn't get to. I hope you'll forgive me for that. Marcus, can I ask, are there other things that need to be said before we close?
Just a couple brief things. I just put in the chat a link. David Benjamin had the idea, let's put someplace discreet on the internet, let's put all the links in one place. And I could hardly think of any place more discreet on the internet than our little St. Julian's Table website, which is very little trafficked. But on there, I made a page that has a number of links if you want to follow to learn more about Dougald's work, David's work, and other folks associated with this series. So that's there. Just for those of us that are in North America, please note next time, so in 2 weeks when we gather again, the clocks in UK, and I assume the rest of Europe, will have already changed, but we won't have changed ours yet. So here where I am in Manitoba, today this meeting started at 2 p.m. On the next time on the, let me get the number, the date right, the 29th, yes. On the 29th, I will start here at 3 p.m. So if you're anywhere here in the Americas, you'll be starting an hour later to join this conversation, just for the next one. And then by the third and the fourth, we'll all be back on the same. We all will have changed our clocks, and we'll be back at the same sort of distance and time from each other. That's all I really wanted to bring to your attention at this point. It's, I know you had some sheep. Expanding the circle significantly beyond the little book club that David hosted with his book, I think that's a couple years ago now already. But I'm quite tickled. It's not quite having to put people in the next auditorium because Illich has sold out the first one. But I think you may have had to boost your Zoom account and I understand Dougald was chipping in on that. So many thanks to that. Yeah, there's a special feature of Dougald here. I just want to encourage folks. Many of you are here because you're paid subscribers already of Dougald's page. If you're not, it's just very well worth it. I've found it just very helpful to have a weekly reflection from Dougald in the last while, and so I highly recommend that. As I would all the other links and folks, but I'll leave it at that for now. So it's 3:29. Thanks, David Benjamin, for keeping us on track time wise. I think, yeah, you're sensitive to the weight of interest and also sensitive to the discipline of sticking with the time that we had. So thanks very much for that. And we'll look forward to, on the 29th will be Sam and Dougald will be improvising the conversation that they will invite us into. So we'll look forward to that 2 weeks from today. Thanks very much, everyone. Peace.